At least 8 Palestinians are killed in the latest Israeli attacks on Gaza, where the total death toll is nearing now 34,400. University protests against Gaza genocide expand worldwide from the U.S. to Europe and Australia. And 2 Palestinians are killed in the occupied West Bank after Israeli forces raid a checkpoint near the city of Jenin. Our top story, more than 200 days into the campaign of genocide in Gaza, and more Palestinian civilians continue losing their lives. Here's a civilian speaking about how a tragedy struck a Palestinian family following an Israeli strike on the southern city of Rafah.
A house was targeted, housing a whole family, a father, a mother, and their 3 children. We were surprised when we heard that all of them got martyred. The father, the mother, and the 3 children. Rescuers and civil defense rushed to the site, and those martyrs and human remains were pulled from the rubble, and they were transferred to hospital. All the family was killed. Nobody left.
In addition to Rafah, the southern city of Khan Yunis witnessed new aerial raids as well. In central Gaza, fresh bombardment on the Nusayrat refugee camp left 8 people dead. Israel's genocidal campaign has killed nearly 34,400 Palestinians since October the 7th. Most of them have been women and children, and that's addition to the more than 77,000 people who have been injured. Meanwhile, relentless Israeli attacks have reduced much of the territory to rubble. A UN official says it will take years to clear the debris caused by over 200 days of bombardment and shelling.
What we do know is that we estimate 37 million tons of debris, which is approximately 300 kilos of debris per square meter. 65% of the buildings that have been destroyed are residential buildings. An estimation has been done based on the current number of tons of debris in Gaza, and with 100 trucks we're talking about 14 years of work with 100 trucks. So that's based on that figure, 14 years to remove with approximately 750,000 person work days to remove the debris.
Lord Hammer also said much of Gaza debris is laced with unexploded ordnances. He added about 10% of the weapons failed to detonate when they were fired on Gaza and have to be removed by demining teams. And apart from the residential buildings, critical infrastructure such as hospitals have been the prime targets of Israeli attacks. Anti-Israel protests also are gaining momentum on U.S. campuses as more and more university students are standing in solidarity with Palestinians. Students camped out for a second day at George Washington University campus despite threats they could be temporarily suspended. The students at Arizona State University also joined wave of U.S. campus protests against ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. In the state of Illinois, hundreds of protesters marched at the University of Chicago campus, and they echoed pro-Palestinian chants that have been reverberating through multiple American universities in recent days. Encampments in support of Palestine also continued at New York's Columbia University. The Education Center is the epicenter of anti-Israel protests since April 18th. In over a week, hundreds of protesters have been arrested at colleges across America. Protesting students are demanding their university authorities divest from companies involved in Israel's war machine. And some of the students have explained reasons behind the growing anger on university campuses. Let's take a listen.
Dozens of universities across the United States who are rising up in solidarity with Gaza and to put an end to the Zionist U.S. genocide against our people. As we remain under the bombs of occupation, resisting genocide and grieving for our martyred colleagues and faculty, and witnessing the destruction of our universities, your global student solidarity is breaking boundaries, and it is time to smash the U.S. imperialist war machine. From Gaza to Columbia to Ann Arbor and Berkeley.
If you are not focusing on the brutal genocide currently happening in Gaza and the apartheid system Palestinians are living under in all of occupied Palestine, we implore you to do so. It is important to remember why we are here. Our encampment here at Columbia and encampments everywhere around the country are part of a larger movement for Palestinian liberation.
We've been in negotiations with the university since Friday, but increasingly we are met with an unwillingness to understand what are the core demands of the student movement. As we've said time and again, at the heart of this action, at the heart of this encampment, is the wish for a complete divestment and boycott of institutions that are complicit in Israel's genocide. Despite this, the university has proposed only further engagement with the apartheid state.
Right now we're here for Gaza because they say they're trying to wipe out Hamas when they're not. And they've shown it over and over again. They're not being precise, let's say, with their attacks. They've shown that they can be precise with something called a surgical strike, but they just haven't. And, you know, bombing hospitals, universities, schools, ambulances, food trucks doesn't really show that you're trying to wipe out a resistance.
The students and other protesters are planning on staying here until all of the demands have been met, which include divesting from anything that has to do with the genocide, and also divulging what, opening the book, saying what is the funding for the school you go to.
We are doing this until we get our demands. We are doing this until the university, UCLA, divests, disclose, ends their silence, academic divestment, and does not continue to, or doesn't use police force for our peaceful protests. Those are our five demands. We will accomplish divestment. We are going to stay here until that. Without divestment, the siege will not end.
Protests and public demonstrations against Israeli genocide are no more longer limited to specific regions, but they continue spreading throughout the globe with participation of many student communities. In Australia, students from universities of Sydney and Melbourne set up camps and protested Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Over 100 students reportedly held a sit-in at the University of Melbourne alone, and they chanted anti-Israel slogans. And in Europe, students in France, Germany, and some other countries also held similar protests despite restrictions. At Sciences Po University in Paris, students blocked an entrance to the campus while holding Palestinian flags as well as chanting slogans. In Berlin, demonstrators clashed with police in front of parliament. Several people were arrested as police violently cleared their encampments. A protest was called on authorities to end providing funds and arms to the Israeli regime. Joining us now from Osaka is Ryan Dawson, geopolitical analyst, for more on the story. Hello, Ryan. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Japan. Ryan, your thoughts, why it took over 200 days and this campaign of genocide on this disproportionate level we have seen to get this students mobilized to pour out in so many countries simultaneously, basically, and oppose what's going on in occupied Palestine.
Yes, this is a movement that goes back at least until 2003. College of William & Mary had divestment movements, I know, because I started them in tandem with the Presbyterian Church and the Methodist Church to divest from Israel. That was a campaign that later morphed into BDS a couple of years after that, boycott, divestment, and sanctions to try and divest from companies benefiting off the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. They pulled the settlements out of Gaza in 2005, but then they've been cyclically bombing them back into the Stone Age. What's different this time is essentially the monopoly on mass media has been broken. And because of Elon Musk with his X platform and then things like Telegram and Substack and Rumble, people are able to organize globally. And the divestment movement is larger than ever. You'll see protests in Australia and the United Kingdom, inside the United States. The United States is a very large country. It's across the nation. Students are protesting the genocide, but also giving concrete solutions about divestment to pull American money out from these corporations involved in blowing up apartments in Gaza.
And so what happened, Ryan, back in 2003 that motivated you and your peers, including the branch of the Christian church you just alluded to get involved against and protest against Israeli authorities?
Well, as you know, even this didn't start on October 7th. They've been abusing Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza my entire life and before I was born. A Palestinian student and myself co-founded a group called Reality in Israel and Palestine, RIP, and at William & Mary in Virginia. And we saw the divestment movement in South Africa and Burma, and we decided, what did they do? What was effective? They had divestment movements. Well, why don't we try that for Israel? And we came up with a lot of pushback from Hillel and all these other organizations, the classic false allegations of anti-Semitism, as if it's anti-Semitic to say stop bulldozing houses. But it wasn't an instant thing. It took a long time. It finally became BDS around 2005. I was at the PSM by then. I met with Diana Butu of the PLO spokeswoman. It's been an ongoing movement that we've been building. But now, because of the sustained violence, usually Israel would go in, blow up a few buildings, maybe kill 100 people. They've killed tens of thousands of children. Right now, they just uncovered mass graves where children were zip-tied, handcuffed, shot, executed, and dumped in a ditch in a mass grave. You can't claim that's Hamas. That's extermination. There isn't a war crime you could name that Israel hasn't committed.
And you know, Ryan, a lot of people don't realize what an abomination it is that U.S. authorities are willing to curtail constitutional freedoms to these young students that you mentioned, freedom to assemble, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. They're willing to violate that to protect Israel's campaign of genocide. And a lot of people can't wrap their minds around what a compromise that is and what a gross denial of someone's constitutional rights that is to take that away from a young student in America right now protesting, to your point, genocide, wholesale massacre of women and children.
They'll frame the issue as about an ethnic group when it's not. It's about a group's behavior, not that the group exists. And their behavior is atrocious and indefensible. I mean, they'll say, we don't feel safe on campus. Look at the campuses in Gaza. You blew them up. Not only do they not face – they can't feel safe at school. Their school doesn't exist. They can't go to the hospital. They can't go to church. They can't go to a mosque. They can't even stay in their own home. 85% of the homes in northern Gaza are gone. They don't have a safe place, and they have almost nothing to eat. That's what you want to talk about: insecurity, food insecurity, physical insecurity. That is the entire population of Gaza, which is the very definition of terrorism, terrorizing an entire population under this flimsy pretext that they're looking for Hamas. Those children that were handcuffed and executed and thrown in a ditch, Hamas wasn't hiding behind them or something. There's no tunnel there. They're just executing people and exterminating the population because they can. They plan on annexing the territory and building more settlements for themselves, as you know, with some mythological rationalization that God awarded the land to them. They are murdering people, and the U.S. is paying for it.
All right, pal. Thanks for hanging out with us, Ryan, and sharing your time with us. Ryan Dawson, their geopolitical analyst, joining us out of Osaka, Japan. And now, Iranian university students have also staged demonstrations in support of the global student movement against Israeli crimes in Gaza. One of these gatherings was held in the University of Tehran, and they chanted anti-Israeli slogans and condemned crackdown on students at American universities. Some of the protesters spoke to our correspondent, Salman Khujuri, who's present at the protest venue.
And we are here together with the other university students to voice our support to the students in Western countries, especially in America and in France. That shows their solidarity to the Palestinian people, that they condemn the help that is being rendered by their country to this Israel. And then what is happening is very, very unbecoming. It has been happening that the police are doing their brutality to the students. And then we have a question to ask. Where are the freedoms? Where are the freedom, especially the freedom of speech? Where is this freedom there? And the freedom of expression. They have the freedom, they are supposed to be allowed to express what they want to express. That is, they have. They are now showing that the country should not help Israel.
We want to say, please stop being hypocrites. Please stop this genocide. We are no longer asleep. We are awake, and all students around the world are awake. Iran's Islamic Republic of Iran has warned the world for more than 4 decades that this is the true color of the Israeli regime. But now their true color has shown itself. Now we can say, hey, we told you. They're the ones, they're the bad guys in the world, and you said, no, Iran's bad. No, Iran's, we should put more sanctions on Iran. No, that's over. Now the whole world now can see the true color of these Zionism, the cool color of these brutals and these savages that are killing humans and humanity around the world.
Israeli forces have murdered 2 more Palestinians during a fresh raid near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Mustafa Abed and Ahmed Shawana were shot dead by occupation forces in the vicinity of the Salem checkpoint. Reports say the Israeli regime is refusing to hand their bodies over to their families. Israeli troops also raided other towns and villages across the occupied West Bank, including Kafr Ain, northwest of Ramallah, Nablus, and Qalqilya. The regime in Tel Aviv has intensified its attacks across occupied territories since it launched its onslaught on Gaza on October 7th, and since then, nearly 492 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Last March, Niger announced that it had ended a defense agreement with the United States and declared American presence in the country as illegal. Now, the cancellation of the military pact between the two countries came after a visit to Niamey by a delegation of senior U.S. military officials led by the Undersecretary of State for African Affairs. Niger ended its military cooperation with the United States months after ejecting French troops from the country. After ending military ties with the United States and former colonial power France, Niger has joined neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso in fostering closer military ties with Russia. Now, the recent arrival of Russian military instructors and equipment was further evidence of Niger's openness to closer cooperation with Moscow. Now, so, will this uranium-rich West African country effectively combat terrorists and insurgents with this new military partner? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. Now, this week we are focusing on the historic move by Niger to end a lopsided military agreement with the U.S. while establishing close defense cooperation with Russia in a bid to restore security in this vast country in the Sahel region. You can be part of today's conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
Niger ejects U.S. military.
Within a period of 1 year, the government of Niger has dealt devastating blows to powerful imperialist powers. Last year, French troops were forced to leave Niger after the government said they failed in their so-called mission of war on terror. This year, Niger's ruling military council, known as the National Council for the Safeguard of the Homeland, revoked a military agreement with the United States after a hostile delegation of senior U.S. military officials visited the Western African country.
A spokesperson for the military council appeared on national TV to announce the decision to revoke the military deal with the United States.
The U.S. presence on the territory of the Republic of Niger is illegal and violates all the constitutional and democratic rules which would require the sovereign people, in particular through its elected representatives, to be consulted on the installation of a foreign army on its territory.
Now, for more on Niger's decision to end military ties with the United States, we have contacted Nimo Bassey, a West African political analyst. Thank you for your time today, sir.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
According to reports, U.S. officials visited Niger and warned the country over its growing ties with Russia and Iran. The Niger authorities were angered by this patronizing attitude by the U.S. officials and decided to cut military ties with Washington. Now, our first question to Mr. Bassey: many African countries have awakened and will no longer allow neo-colonial powers to order them around. So why is the United States still adamant on imposing its will on African people?
The truth is that powerful nations such as the United States would not easily read changes about attitudes, about expectations and relationships with countries that they have dominated for many years. And so we are not surprised that they went in that condescending manner to discuss with the leaders of Niger Republic. After having had so much space to operate in that country, including running a massive airports or air facilities for deployment of drones and other equipment, they must have thought that they've got the country in their pocket. But really, as your question says, Africa is waking up, and Africa will continue to wake up. And we can see the signs, and I believe this is the time for colonial countries, those who have colonized Africa, and those who think they still have a right to run roughshod over the continent, to really sit down and review their policies.
For years, the U.S. maintained a major drone base in Niger with hundreds of troops to ostensibly battle terrorist groups. From Niger's perspective, the U.S. presence in the country has failed to crush the activities of armed groups and terrorists. In fact, according to reports, terrorism increased in Niger and across the Sahel after U.S. troops entered the region.
Hundreds took to the streets of Niger's capital recently to demand the departure of U.S. troops that still remain in the country even after the government ordered them to leave.
This mobilization is the Nigerian people's call to the American government to set a timetable for withdrawing its troops from our country. We hope that the American government will take precautions to prevent any escalation.
Previously, our authorities were against military agreements with the French, and we supported their stance until the French forces departed. Today, we are once again demonstrating to demand the departure of American forces from our country. We request that the Americans leave our territory. The United States must recognize that Niger is a sovereign state. Just like them, we are free to establish relations with whomever we want, as long as it is done in the spirit of mutual benefit.
We have seen a rise in attacks against government troops and civilians in Niger. Now, Mr. Bassey, could the U.S. and indeed France be trying to sabotage the government of Niger to create conditions for the continuing presence of their troops in this country?
Niger has a right to call for a halt of the presence of foreign troops on their territory that they don't agree with. And in fact, if you look at the level of investment in military installation in Niger, build airports, built at least one of the airports, costs about $100 million. That's a whole lot of money that could have been used otherwise. And so to invest that in a place, I don't think that was charity. It couldn't have been solely for the benefit of the Nigerians. It must have been for other purposes that the Nigerians may just have realized that this is not worth it. And so, yes, the kind of arrangements, both in the Sahel, both in Niger and other parts of the world, is quite disturbing. And it's at this time in history, we need to build global peace by allowing ourselves to go into strategic solidarity as determined by individual countries.
Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have signed a mutual defense pact known as the Alliance of Sahel States, aiming to help each other against possible threats of armed rebellion or external aggression. The foreign minister of Burkina Faso explains.
We're already fighting terrorism with full responsibility. You know that Burkina, Mali, and Niger have made enormous progress recently in the fight against terrorism. I was talking earlier about reclaiming our instruments, and that's part of it. Today, you're going to Burkina Faso. We have a better structured army. We have volunteers who partner with the military to try to defend our lands because you can't outsource your security.
The three Sahel countries have cut military ties with Western colonial powers and have moved to establish defense relations with Eastern powers. Now, last question to Mr. Bassé. In your opinion, how can Africa solve its mounting security challenges?
Now, Africa really needs to do everything possible to tackle terrorism and insurgents, because apart from being destructive, they are extremely destructive. And, you know, but we would have loved to see more of a coordination of the entire continent, of one Africa having a defense infrastructure or defense arrangement, a defense architecture. But what we're seeing now in the Alliance of Sahel States could be a precursor of what may come, but it could also be a step towards fragmenting efforts at defending the nation, the nations of the continent. And so it's both something that we could say is interesting, it's also very disturbing. Now, these countries have a right to come together to defend their territories and defend themselves and support one another. But the question is, should Africa be having these micro units, or should we be looking for one big African continent, one country, a kind of Pan-Africanist approach? So I would hope that what has happened would force the leaders of the continent at the level of the African Union to sit down and think about the infrastructure for defense, the defense architecture for the continent.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have a unified defense architecture to effectively tackle the continent's conflicts. I'd like to thank Nimo Bassé for his insight, and then I'll take a short break. And when we come back, we shall focus on Niger's security cooperation with Russia. Stay with us.
Niger's security cooperation with Russia.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Immediately after the coup, the people demanded a cancellation of military ties with Western countries, particularly France and the United States. The authorities revoked military agreements with these two imperialist powers and decided to look eastwards in a bid to solve the country's security challenges.
It is within this framework that Russian military trainers recently arrived in Niger with an air defense system and other equipment. A Russian military instructor speaks here after arriving in Niamey, the capital city of Niger.
We're here to train the Nigerian army using the military equipment that has arrived here. We're here to develop military cooperation between Russia and Niger.
To discuss deepening military ties between Niger and Russia, we have contacted Adib Sahani. He's the executive director at the JTK Center for Human Security and Peace Building. He's also a security analyst. Thanks for your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Now, as we have seen, the Russian military trainers are in Niger to reinforce the country's security as the West African country pulls away from close cooperation with the U.S. and France. Now, a question to Mr. Adib. Now, what's your take on this move by Niger?
Well, we do recall that since the French left Niger, there's been an increase in the number of attacks against not just Nigerian military personnel and installation, but against civilians as well. We have seen a massive, you know, hike in the number of attacks, and it puts the Nigerian regime in a very precarious situation. That is why, in the first place, a Sahel alliance was formed between them and Mali and Burkina Faso. But every country within the Sahel alliance is grappling with terrorism. So for you to have one country to move to the aid of another country becomes difficult. That is why it was imperative that the Nigerian authorities look anywhere, wherever they can get help. And surely the Russians provided them that alternative. So the Russians are in to help them in the form of logistics, in the form of training, and perhaps direct involvement in fighting the terrorists who have gained a bit of a ground in the past few months.
The arrival of Russian specialists in Niger includes the installation of an air defense system. The air defense system is seen as critical for Niger as the country seeks to protect its sovereignty.
While discussing the bilateral agenda, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Israel's interim leader Abdurrahman Tiani expressed the intention to intensify political dialogue and development of mutually beneficial cooperation in a wide range of areas. Now, Niger is a uranium-rich country that has for decades seen France loot these critical natural resources, nuclear energy. Mr. Adib, now, will this cooperation with Russia see the people of Niger eventually benefiting from the uranium in their country?
Well, I mean, according to different sources, the country has been plundered for many years on end. And it is important that African leaders see the need for strategic alliances. So whatever agreement or partnership you go into, you have to do with having in mind the strategic interests of your country. It is unfair for other countries to come in and plunder resources when our people don't benefit. In fact, where the resource is found, there are no routes to that area. Women and children especially don't have access to basic necessities of life, including healthcare, water, sanitation, and all that. So we have to really, you know, take a closer look at some of these things and go into partnerships that would help the citizens of, you know, both countries.
During last year's Russia-Africa summit, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned African nations about Western pursuit of colonial practices, saying that the situation in many countries of the continent is unstable due to a tough legacy of colonialism. He said Africa and Russia share similar aspirations.
Most importantly, Russia and Africa share our inherent aspiration to defend true sovereignty and the right for our own path of development in the political, economic, social, cultural, and other areas. Such aspiration to independence and sovereignty does not equal self-isolation. Quite the contrary, it means openness and cooperation of the free states and peoples, states as equals in their rights. Sovereignty is not something you achieve. It is something you have to keep fighting for to maintain.
Some analysts contend that Russia is a superpower that has shown honesty in its geopolitical relations with Africa. Now, my last question to Mr. Adib. Now, is this assertion correct in your opinion?
Well, many African leaders are looking for alternatives, okay? Some are tired of being told what to do before they get aid. As a result, Russia is the alternative. That is why I wasn't surprised the number of African leaders who honored President Putin's invitation for the Russia-Africa summit. And I've also seen that many African leaders are interested in new partnerships and alliances. And surely Russia provides the best alternative.
Well, very well put there. The nations of Africa only want alliances based on mutual benefit. I'd like to thank our guest there, Adib Sani, for his insight today. Welcome to the Africa Rising section that focuses on interesting events in Africa, from innovations, achievements in science and technology, to arts and culture. Now today, we're talking to Professor Tinike Maluleke, the Vice Chancellor of Tshwane University of Technology in South Africa. He's also a leading and internationally recognized researcher in religion and politics, as well as Black and African theologies. Thanks a lot for your time, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Now, Professor, you have been a judge in the Alan Peyton Award, a South African Literary Award for Nonfiction, and also a judge in the MTA National Annual Radio Awards. Now, can you elaborate on these two awards?
The Alan Peyton Literary Awards is probably the top literature award in the country nationally. It was started several decades ago. And it basically awards the top prizes for the best books in nonfiction on the one hand, and the best books in fiction. As for the MTN Radio Awards, it's a similar thing, but now focused on radio, South African radio, and the programs that are broadcast on radio, to check as to which programs are the best. So they go with program types. So the afternoon drive show, the morning shows, for example, the talk shows, and then they look at which one is the most popular, not just in terms of listenership, but also in terms of other objective criteria.
Now, thank you for that, Professor. Now, we know that you have written over 100 articles, and one of your articles that is outstanding is Black and African Theology After Apartheid and After the Cold War. Now, what was your motivation in writing this article?
As we all know, in 1989 was a watershed year in the world. Mm-hmm. In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. In 1989, Gorbachev took to the leadership of the USSR and oversaw the great changes that happened. In this article, I look at the implications of those great global changes for Africa in general, but also for South Africa in particular, particularly looking at the implications of those changes for politics in South Africa, politics in Africa, and more importantly, for religion and culture in Africa, religion and culture in South Africa. What does it mean to be part of a world where the Cold War was no longer the dominant factor in the world for Africa and for South Africa? That's the question I try to answer.
Okay, now, Professor, one of your articles that also grabbed my attention is titled Racism en Route, an African Perspective. Now, in your opinion, how did imperialist powers ignite racism that led to the exploitation of African people?
The second negative impact that Africans and South Africans have suffered has been that of colonialism. Colonialism being the period when European powers divided up the African continent and rationed it out between and among themselves. Behind and above and below both slavery and colonialism, what you have is racism. At the heart of slavery is racism.
Yeah.
At the heart of colonialism is racism. And basically, racism is the suggestion that African people and black people are not as human as white people. That's how it was experienced in Africa.
Now, last question, Professor. Unfortunately, as we know, imperialist powers are still pillaging Africa's resources, and therefore the continent is not truly emancipated. Now, why are these colonial powers still controlling many parts of Africa directly or even indirectly, despite the fact that African countries have attained their independence?
Colonialism and racism, as well as slavery, are not only military projects.
Yeah.
They are also psychological and mental projects.
Yeah.
And so many African leaders realized a long time ago that to defeat imperialists, you need to defeat them, not merely militarily, because it was almost impossible at the beginning to do that, but you need to defeat them using your psychological resources, using your cultural resources, using your religious resources. And these have been used for a long, long time to fight against racism and colonialism, and they continue to be used now. And of course, the psychological war and the cultural war is incomplete. It continues now, because if people live under colonialism and under slavery for hundreds of years, it will take time to remove out of them the mentalities and the psychologies that come with that.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. Unfortunately, our time is over for now. I'd like to thank Professor Maluleke, the Vice Chancellor of Shwane University of Technology in South Africa. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Assalamu alaikum to all dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program of For a Better Life, we are honored to present you a comprehensive introduction to the Iranian poets, writers, and famous artists, and elaborate on the very important messages they had, connecting the moral issues and ethics to even literature and works of art. While we investigate the relation and sign of their belief by comparing them to their religion roots, to see to what extent our artists were confirming or reassuring the message of the Holy Islam. Human beings are members of a whole, in creation of one essence and soul. If one member is afflicted with pain, other members uneasy will remain. If you have no sympathy for human pain, the name of human you cannot retain. This artwork titled Human Dignity has graced the walls of the United Nations building since 2014. The artist's inspiration, one of the lines of the famous poem by Saadi, Human Beings, rendered here in three languages, Persian, English, and French. And this beautifully emotive poem called Bani Adam, Humankind, drafted in the 13th century, the Persian Muslim polymath Saadi used what can be employed as an analogy to our current challenge in order to visualize this common constitution of humanity. April 21 is Saadi Day in commemoration of Saadi Shirazi as a great Persian poet and prose writer of the medieval period. Saadi is recognized for the quality of his writings and for the depth of his social and moral thoughts. He was born in Shiraz around 1200 and died around 1292. Abu Muhammad Maslahad-Din ibn Abdullah Shirazi, known by his pen name Saadi, was one of the major Persian poets of the medieval period. Saadi is known as a mystic and metaphysician in the history of Persian literature. He is recognized for the quality of his writings and for the depth of his social and moral thoughts. The ancient scholar has gained worldwide fame, not only in the Persian-speaking countries, but in Western societies, with his poems being quoted in a multitude of sources. You know, mentioning Saadi's best-known masterpieces, we can find Bustan, The Arkard, completed in 1257, and Gulistan, The Flower Garden, in 1258. The Bustan is a book of Persian verse written in 1257 by Sheikh Saadi Shirazi. Saadi was a poet who was widely recognized as one of the masters of classical Persian literature, and is considered to be one of his two greatest works. The Bustan is Saadi's first work and literally means the Arkard. The title is a metaphor for the contents of the book, which are the fruits of Saadi's long experience, journeys, his judgments on life, and his understanding of human philosophy. It is peppered with various anecdotes. Bustan is similar to fables with regards to the moral advice rendered. It is divided into 10 chapters, each of which is dedicated to a particular virtue. The verses have been written in Mathnavi or rhyming couplets style. It was even translated into Dutch in 1688. Busan was acclaimed as one of the 100 greatest books of all time. It is a mine of proverbs, quotations, and practical wisdom that holds good to this very day. It is said that even if Busan were the only work that reminded of Sa'di's genius, his name would still be considered among the literary immortals. Golestan, comprised of 8 chapters, is mainly prose. The book widely addresses king's morality, dervish's behavior, benefits of contentment, silence and talking in proper time, love and youthfulness, weaknesses in old age, and education. Sa'di attempts to advise people to live freely and to improve the quality of their lives in Golestan. Now, you may come to this question that why do we even love Sa'di and listen to his advice? Well, the answer is here. The fact is that the words and freshness of Sa'di's poetry, as well as the foresight and wisdom of the tales of this famous Iranian poet, are so transcendent that anyone, without any reason, is enchanted by the balanced spread and moderation in his poetry. Sa'di's poetry reminds sympathy as the essence of human existence, as a balanced approach to daily life that can uproot many conflicts in a society. Avoiding controversy in word and deed, and turning to a common gentle attitude for how to behave and live in coexistence is promoted in Sa'di's poetry. Sa'di's 2 best-known masterpieces, Bostan and Golestan, in both prose and verse, these 2 put an emphasis on a unity in mankind and interdependence regardless of social barriers and labels. Sa'di is probably the first Persian poet to have been translated into European languages. A German version of the Golestan appeared in 1654. Sa'di's tomb is located in southern Shiraz, called Sa'diye, and is one of Iran's major tourist attractions. Lines from Sa'di's poem are still commonly used in conversations by Iranians today. Many Persian elements have been used in the architecture of Sa'di's tomb. It is also a national heritage site. It's a surprise that the effect of what Sa'di has written years ago, that a sense of joining people and standing next to each other, is officially connecting people. The moral messages in his works are countless, but this probably most famous one is injecting its effect on the minds of people. What makes it even more tangible is that this very face exists there, that the moral message and ethical lessons of his work, like many other Iranian authors, poets, writers, and scholars, are observed in the religious roots as well. Sa'di, who himself was a Muslim and even wrote poems to praise the Prophet, has mentioned the rules of supporting each other. And as you all know, it is one of the principles of our faith to help our fellow human beings. We have a compiled list of acts that you can do to help others. Some are obvious and others are often overlooked, but of great importance too. In the Quran, Allah says, "Help one another in acts of piety and righteousness, and do not assist each other in acts of sinfulness and transgression. And be aware of Allah, verily Allah is severe in punishment." Many hadith said by the Prophet of Mercy, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, assure the importance of cooperation, helping others and offering them a hand. Do you remember that our generous Prophet considered faith be incomplete until one loves for his brother what he loves for himself? He considers who sleeps and knows his neighbor is starving, his faith is incomplete, and also who is visited by a guest and fails to honor, his faith is incomplete. The great Prophet said, "Anyone who believes in Allah on the last day should not harm his neighbor, and anyone who believes in Allah on the last day should entertain his guest generously, and anyone who believes in Allah on the last day or keep quiet." And it is very nice that the message behind our poet's masterpiece is a repetition or maybe an inspiration of what has been taught by Islam. And this great message would lead the different generations of today towards both thoughtfulness and religion, which is unbelievably magnificent. It's somehow like here in these cases, we've got the art of Islam, the picture of the beauty which can never be ignored. Well, we've come to the end and we don't have much more time left. But before we end, I would like to ask you for a favor. If you haven't had any chances to read about these great poets and artists, give it a try. Go and read some books and try to see the deep connections between these messages and what Allah has mentioned and what our religion has to offer. Thank you for being with me today on For a Better Life. Till the next topic and the next conversation about the new interesting topics. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.